Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. One of the most deeply held ethos in America is that it's a place for second chances. My guest today is a Chicago-based young artist, Jessica Harvey, who explores myths like that, the myths people create about themselves and the places they hold dear. And there's no better place to explore than Route 66, which has recreated itself over and over, from a refugee road to a road of post-war prosperity to the desolation and decay of ruralism with the advent of the interstate to a new nostalgia for the slow lane. Face it, the old mother road is a mother lode of stories and myths. While Harvey is a Chicago native, she knew very little about the road until she began her investigation, and she credits Tulsan Michael Wallace as her, quote, spirit animal, unquote, in finding her own unique Route 66. And what she found is a part of an ongoing exhibit at AHA in the Brady District. Mother Road, an exploration of Route 66, is an evolving exhibit during the artist's seven-week residency here in Tulsa. Jessica Harvey is a graduate of Cranbrook Academy of Art and spent 2 years in Iceland on a Fulbright grant where she explored Icelanders' complex relationship with the U.S. military, which occupied bases on the island during World War II and the Cold War. Her work has been exhibited at the Urban Institute for Contemporary Art in Grand Rapids, Michigan, the Center for Contemporary Photography in Detroit, as well as the Cranbrook Art Museum. As a part of the exhibit, there will be a special film showing this Saturday at 3 o'clock, actually at the Woody Guthrie Center. Tulsa, Finding 66 will feature a panel discussion featuring Ed Taylor and TCC journalism students. And the artist will be giving an artist talk and slideshow on November 6th at the Hardesty Art Center. Jessica Harvey is our guest today. Jessica Harvey, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Your show's been open for a couple of weeks, and I would assume you're probably hearing a wide variety of reactions about Route 66. How did you get the idea about doing an art project around Route 66?
Well, the idea for the project for Route 66 actually came after I was visiting, of all places, Iceland. I was in Iceland on a Fulbright grant for a year. And I had done a lot of traveling there by myself, so I did a lot of these solo road trips. And when I came back to the States, I really wanted to be a little bit more grounded in America, and I thought, what would be a great American road trip? And, you know, the obvious answer would be Route 66. I think that's the iconic road trip for America, though. So, that's when I started thinking about doing a project on Route 66, actually.
Now, that's not an original idea.
No.
I mean, you know, I mean, all sorts of people. I was just watching public TV a couple of weeks ago, and Billy Connolly, you know, the Irish or Scottish actor, was doing the same thing in a television series. What did you hope to find on Route 66 that others haven't, or was it just more a drive of exploration, just to see what you could see?
At first, it was definitely a drive of exploration, but I did think about that. You know, when I thought about Route 66, there's so many people that have documented, you know, like the neon or the road itself, the people.
The motels. I mean, virtually every aspect of
yes.
the road.
Yeah. And so one of the things that I thought about a lot when I was traveling was just how traveling is changing. But when I started on the trip, it definitely was a trip of exploration, where I had never actually traveled in the Southwest before, so I had actually never been to Arizona or New Mexico. And when I was traveling, especially in those places, it was kind of a lot of me just getting used to the physical landscape itself and the land. And something that stuck with me throughout the trip was just thinking about the history of the place and the land itself and how much history it's seen throughout its lifetime.
And, of course, Route 66 is a place where you will see crazy things you don't see anywhere else, some of which you've documented and others that you haven't. But I know that you ran across, like out in western Texas, which is flat as a pancake, all of a sudden, way off in the distance, you'll see this gigantic cross.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And it's out in the middle of nowhere, basically. There's a one shot in the show of, I assume it's some sort of sculpture of this big cowboy. It's called the Second Amendment Cowboy.
Yes, also in Texas.
Yeah.
But there's just so much, and I think there's so much iconic things when you're traveling the road. Like, I didn't want to get wrapped up in these icons that are photographed all the time. So in the exhibit right now, it's kind of set up where I have a suite of about 10 larger photographs, and then I have a display of 25 or so smaller photographs. And what I'm doing at my time at AHA is I'm going to be making these smaller publications, so one for each state. And that will have some of the images that have been printed smaller, but in this little book, where it'll also have some of my writings, where I can kind of tie in, you know, what I was thinking while I was taking this trip, and also the imagery itself.
Well, your artist statement says you're wanting to explore the myths of a place and of how we create our own myths. And I think when you're talking about Route 66, that's sort of the mother load for the mother road. I mean, it's there's so many different things you could focus on. Did you just sort of keep an open mind as you were driving down the highway? Because there's some really interesting pictures in this that, you know, you say, well, I've never seen that in that part of the country before. I mean, you were really looking for different things.
I was looking for different things, and I was just trying to stay away from things that have been most photographed, because there's a lot of things that are on the road that have been photographed a lot, and people that have just so much more knowledge of these things that I don't know if I could have added anything more to the conversation. There's a piece that I'm a little bit more of a conceptual piece that I'm working on right now that does take some of the neon signs, and I've drawn them, and I'm actually going to make a larger cyanotype print. But rather than you identifying them as neon signs, they're kind of be symbols or hieroglyphs, or petroglyphs was actually like what I was referencing when there were so many. When I got to the Southwest, I started thinking about that language and petroglyphs and the language of people who had been there before, and how we're trying to decipher things that we have no starting point. So we're making this language or assumption of this language based on things that we don't know. So it's kind of doing that. We'll be doing that for the neon signs as well.
Now, what's unusual about this residency? You're actually in residence at the museum and at the gallery and working on things every day, right?
Yes, I am.
So people are coming up to you and talking to you and saying, what does this particular photograph mean? You know, I've never seen this on Route 66. I mean, what's that process been like?
That process has been really interesting because the trip that I took was a month-long trip. So I took a month to go from Chicago.
So you took a lot of photographs then.
I took a lot of...
A lot of iconic photographs as well as non.
Yeah, I took a lot of photographs, spent a lot of time with myself. I actually brought a field recorder with myself so I could take notes while I was driving, because I had friends who offered to call me so I wouldn't be, you know, always alone on the road. But when you're traveling Route 66, you realize that there really isn't a lot of cell phone service for the majority of the trip. So I actually ended up making these recordings and not only notes to myself about ideas or what I was thinking at the time, but then it also ended up being kind of a vehicle for me to communicate. So I recorded probably a couple hours of recordings and probably just me. I don't know. There's definitely some of me singing.
I think there is a thing of you singing the 50 songs that make me cry.
Yeah. So that's another project in and of itself. But this is just all audio of me basically talking to, not to myself, but to an invisible someone. So that's going to be an audio. I mean, I kind of dread a little bit editing that because listening to hours of yourself is not really what I had anticipated doing, but I'm going to be making that an audio component in the piece as well.
Well, what's really interesting about the show is it probably won't take shape until the very end of the show, right? Is that sort of the goal?
That is the goal, because I want it to kind of be this changing, moving exhibit. So I have these vitrines that have these artifacts that kind of left up maybe more to the viewer to create their own story of the things that are in these vitrines, while they might have specific personal meanings to myself.
I was thinking of one object that was, I think you picked up at Meteor Crater, which was, I guess, some sort of magnet to pick up fragments of the meteor strike.
Yes.
Out near Winslow, Arizona, yeah.
Yeah, I was definitely interested in the physical Earth itself, and I had missed going to Meteor Crater on my way to California, but I really hustled to get there at the end. I think I had actually only maybe a half hour to spend there. Mm-hmm. There's definitely a lot of earth elements in the vitrines themselves, but there are labels on each of the vitrines, and labels are pretty important to me in my own work, as not saying specifically what things are, but they kind of lead as an entry point for people to create their own story about the artifacts or things that are in front of them.
There's also a slideshow exhibit which features a very peaceful water on one side, and then I assume it's, you know, Lake Michigan and the ocean. And in the middle, you're sort of changing a view of photographs. This is something that's taking shape as well? Or
That I do have two more rolls of film that need to be developed, but that was taken along the trip, and I got the film processed actually in California before I came back, because I did want that component to be ready for the show, because I had about 6 days after I got back from the trip to print everything and have the vitrines made and put everything together for the show. So I was trying to hurry really fast. And
so each day is just a process of actually creating an exhibit, really?
Yeah, each day is definitely an editing process because I'm going through a lot of images every day.
Is part of what you're putting into the exhibit, the feedback you're getting from viewers that are seeing this in process at all?
I think where the viewers will come in mostly actually will be, I'm asking people to come into the gallery, and I've set up some appointments this week for it to happen, where they come and tell me their personal stories about Route 66, because right now I think what my exhibit is probably lacking is a lot of that human element, and I want to make an audio piece that tells people's personal stories. And I feel like Route 66 definitely has a tendency to become whitewashed, and, you know, people look at it as this, like, happy, nostalgic road, though it was a road that had seen a lot of hard times.
It was a refugee road.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think some people, like, I think that we're maybe a little bit far removed from that history where people don't really remember that point in time, but, you know, even in the 50s and 60s, if you're an African-American person, it was very hard to travel the road. They had like a travel book called The Green Book that was printed.
Right. All throughout the South as well, yeah.
Yeah. But
where you could stop, where you could find a restroom, where you could find a place that would serve you, or a place where you could spend the night, yeah.
Yeah, and so I'm interested in those stories as well. I don't want it to necessarily be just stories about this happy, nostalgic road. Because it really, I think, deserves more than that since it has such a great history.
And the road is as much about hard times as good times, too. Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of the road has been abandoned for the most part. It's now interstate for the most part. And when you're actually traveling the road, you see hard time, depression, really, because that whatever prosperity was there is gone now.
Yeah, and that it's definitely evident. And I think there's been a lot of people who have documented that part of the road really well. And that was something I think that I want to steer away from, so it didn't just become, I mean, I lived outside of Detroit for a couple of years while I was going to graduate school, and they had this term called ruin porn, where people just document these abandoned buildings, and the conversation about Detroit wouldn't be about anything else that was going on besides this devastation.
The city that's just basically collapsing. Yeah.
Right. And right. So I wanted to kind of steer away from that conversation as much as I could when talking about Route 66.
Well, what are the myths that came to you as you're driving this road and learning about it?
Well, one of my absolute favorite stops was in Seligman, Arizona, where I was able to early one morning meet and talk with Angel Delgadillo, who runs he's 87 years old. He's retired, but he has this, though very active, he is active in community meetings. He had just come from one the day before when I met with him. And he was very pivotal in starting this revitalization of Route 66. And so he owns this barber shop, and his family runs a gift store that's within the barber shop. And he is just so full of life. And I had a conversation with him about when Route 66 got moved and Interstate 40 started.
Right, because Seligman is that portion of western Arizona which has been bypassed by I-40, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And so, you know, he saw all these businesses become devastated, and, you know, he really wanted to do something about it. And he has been a really vocal, active participant in bringing tourism and bringing commerce back to Route 66. And the thing I just remember the most, there's a few things, but one thing is just his eyes were so full of life. And when he was talking about, you know, them bringing people back to Route 66, he had this one quote that really stuck with me when he talked about how the people have the power. And he kept on reiterating that, and being able to talk to him, it was just really a treat, because I had to get there before 8 o'clock to talk to him, because right at 8 o'clock, a busload of French tourists were coming just to meet him and see his shop. So,
well, you know, that's the whole thing, is he's like one of the first. I know he's, but every state has got one of those persons mm-hmm. in them that sort of believe in this road,
right?
That may have given them riches in maybe other parents or something like that. And they're about trying to reclaim that. That's kind of an interesting American ethos when you think about it.
Yeah, it really is. And it was really a great time for me. Yeah.
My guest today is Jessica Harvey. She's an artist and photographer. She's currently in residence at AHA. Mother Road, an exploration of Route 66, is on display and taking shape through her residency, which will be on display through November 23rd. I noticed when I was there in the gallery, you had a whole selection of newspapers. Is this going to become sort of a road document of sort? I assume you're collecting newspapers as you traveled back and forth on the road.
So the newspapers were acting as a document, kind of just to trace the point in time when I traveled. So I would get a newspaper in each town that I stayed at on each night. So there's about 30 newspapers. I had a couple there's one especially windy day, and they just blew out of my car. So there's a couple of LA Times that are missing. But other than that, there is a paper just to kind of represent the place that I was at that time, because the news definitely changes and the newspaper styles change depending on the place.
Well, you know, really on a conceptual level, you're driving about a road that is sort of antiquated and, you know, sort of forgotten. Maybe newspapers are, newspapers, the future for them are looking, if not bleak, at least not great. Mm-hmm. So there's almost a conceptual element to that.
Yeah, it'll be definitely interesting to see how they hold up throughout the time there.
Oh. Well, how many art projects, will this sort of be like a immersive art exhibit by the time it's all finished? Or how do you envision this looking by the time you finish your residency?
I think some elements will be kept pretty similar. I'm working on editing a video that's of the sunrise and the sunset facing each other from Lake Michigan mm-hmm. and the Pacific Ocean. That's a little bit different from the one that's going on right now. But I think the structure of the gallery space will probably stay the same. I think what's going to change mostly will probably be the content, either what's in the vitrines, what's on the walls, and what people tell me and what their stories uncover.
Mm-hmm. This is not the first project like this. You did when you were in Iceland. You did sort of a similar project like this where you were basically learning about Icelandic culture, and you basically did a project based on how, you know, there was such an American influence on Iceland because it was a Cold War sort of occupied country through World War II and the Cold War, and you did a project on that. Tell us a little bit about that.
So from 2011-2012, I was in Iceland, and I've never been to Iceland before. I had always wanted to go to Iceland. One of my really good friends from graduate school is Icelandic, and her husband are just amazing artists and creators, and I thought that this part of history was really interesting. It was something I wasn't very familiar with. I hadn't realized that the U.S. occupied Iceland during World War II.
Now, is that controversial in Icelandic history, or was it considered necessary, or you know, a big waste of money? What exactly?
So I don't want to speak for all of the Icelandic people, but
from
what I thought, from my viewpoint, the actual occupation itself was called the Lovely War. It was nicknamed that.
The Lovely War?
The Lovely War, because there was actually a
brought lots of money into Iceland.
It did. It brought lots of money. It brought infrastructure. It brought a lot of culture. It brought, you know, like rock and roll music. it brought different foods into Iceland. And while there was actually some loss of life, because Iceland was a strategic place for World War II, it was where they shipped the Arctic convoys from mm-hmm. Iceland to USSR. So there was loss of life, but it was very small in comparison to other countries that had participated in the war. There was a huge population boom, which that was actually probably pretty controversial at the time, where servicemen came and then they left, and you know, there was a large population left behind. But what I thought was interesting was after World War II was over, we did come back for the Cold War, and then we had a military presence there till the base closed in 2006. And I think that in 2006, when the base closed, that was pretty upsetting because it employed thousands of Icelanders full time. And when we left, their financial crisis happened.
The Icelandic fishermen decided to become multinational bankers. which has been well documented, the whole insanity of their particular banking crisis. But that also happened at the same time. The United States left a big hole in their economy.
Yeah. So, yeah, it happened. Theirs happened first, and then our. And
so was there a lot of nostalgia for that? I mean, much like
for
Route 66? Yeah, for the nostalgia for that whole era when the United States was in Iceland.
No, I think that Iceland really considers itself a fiercely independent country. So I think maybe in terms of the Americans being there, the people that I talked to, it seemed like it was a part of history that they just wanted to forget about because it was, at the time, still a little bit painful to talk about.
Now, you went around and took photographs of, like, the abandoned bases, I assume, from World War II as well as the Cold War era.
So there's one main base in Reykjavik, Keflavik, which is in Keflavik, just outside of Reykjavik. So that base still exists, and that base is being turned into like active space. So artists have studios there. There's businesses that have there. So at the time I was there, it was kind of in this half abandoned, half used space. And so I think they want to turn it into, 100% used space. But then when I had actually got to Iceland, I saw how far reaching the U.S. impact was on the country. So I was looking for the old Kwanzaa huts, which were actually the houses,
World War II housing.
Mm-hmm, World War II housing that the U.S. Military service people lived in. And it was spread throughout the entire country. So that's how I ended up on the road trip, was just trying to find these old Kwanzaa huts throughout. And there are a couple military bases, one in the east. There's one in the east and one not too far from Reykjavik that are actually bases that are pretty intact from World War II.
Mm. Now, of course, you have that gorgeous Icelandic scenery, which is that sort of magnificent desolation in a lot of senses, and great natural beauty. Did you use that as a backdrop, or was it more focus on these old buildings and falling into disuse?
It was actually more focused onto the old buildings because some of them have actually been, the majority of them are on farms and used on farmland, but some of them have actually been repurposed and they've been turned into maybe like an auto body shop or like a storage facility. But the way that I usually display those is kind of is in a big grid. So I have those, and the landscape images that came out of the Iceland project were kind of more of a result of me being on these road trips by myself. So I show the work together in context with some other objects, but I also have shown them both separately.
Well, it sounds like a really interesting experience. You can see it taking shape at AHA. And I assume, is this sort of an ongoing area of exploration, of taking sort of these adventures and sort of finding out about a place and creating an art project from it? Is that what you're going to be doing down the road?
Yes, definitely. I do have a binder full of, projects I would like to do. And sometimes an opportunity arises where I'm able to pursue that project. But I always have things in the back of my mind. Definitely something I'll be working on in the future.
All right. Well, it's a pleasure to get to know you. And thanks very much. I hope a lot of people come out to see the work at AHA. Thanks.
Thank you.
Artist Jessica Harvey speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. Her evolving exhibit, Mother Road, an exploration of 66, continues on display along with her residency through November 23rd. Two special events going on in the next couple of weeks. This Saturday at 3 o'clock, there'll be a showing of the film Tulsa Finding 66 at 3 o'clock at the Woody Guthrie Center. And then on November 6th, the artist will give a talk and slideshow at 6:30 at the Hardesty Arts Center. The artist is also looking for local residents to share their stories about Route 66. You can learn more about all of that at ahatulsa.org. You're listening to Studio Tulsa. Here's the comments of Barry Friedman.
For the first time in about 30 years, I was not at Temple Israel for the Jewish high holidays of Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. I was at B'nai Emunah. There's an old joke in Judaism, and it may be one of the best, about a Jewish man, let's call him Saul, who goes to a deserted island where he builds two temples, one slightly more elaborate than the other. Inexplicably, though, he goes to the less swanky of the two. His friends eventually come visit and see his two creations. They are impressed by the first, but marvel at the second. "Sol," they say, "that one is exquisite." "Yes," says Sol, "you couldn't pay me to walk into that place." Like most people in faith, I imagine, Jews too need somebody within the faith to be angry at, which is why there are usually two Jewish places of worship in a town, regardless of the size. We need some place not to go. Now, I wasn't angry at Temple Israel, not at all, but I was exhausted. Rabbi Sherman had retired, my daughter moved away, my uncle and aunt were no longer members, and if a building is special only because it holds the ones you love, this wasn't anymore. My son's memorial service was here, as was the ceremony for my second marriage, which ended in divorce. So Temple Israel was no longer a refuge, no longer hallowed. In fact, it was hollow. So I decided to move my membership to B'nai Emunah and Rabbi Fitzerman, who has always been a dear friend, and like Rabbi Sherman, incalculably smarter than I am, a trait I always look for in rabbis, if not car salesmen. It has a different feel at B'nai. There's no red wall, as there is at Temple Israel, no procession up the aisle by Sherman and board members to begin services. At B'nai, the rabbis and the hazan, the cantor, just seem to appear. It is the more conservative of the two, so men are required to wear talluses and yarmulkes. At Temple Israel, it's optional. Yet there's something informal about the formality at B'nai that's infectious. While men daven, swaying and rocking and reciting Jewish liturgy, babies in the sanctuary are screaming like banshees. During other parts of the service, people meet and hug and joke about weight gain and hair loss. At Temple Israel, Rabbi Sherman ran a much tighter ship, even though it was the Reform congregation. Screaming babies got one or two screams before their mothers or fathers knew to usher them to the lobby. There was no chit-chatting during sermons. At both places, though, there was the struggle between modernity and history, one's Judaism versus one's Jewishness. Rabbi Sherman once said from the pulpit on Kol Nidre, the eve of Yom Kippur, "No Jewish child should be in school tomorrow. If we don't respect ourselves, our faith, how can we expect anyone else to?" It's probably too much for any building, any congregation, any rabbi, paint job, or hazan's voice to bring you closer to God, but I'm not even sure that's why I go anymore. My father has been with me the last few years, once at Temple Israel, once in Las Vegas at a service officiated by two Russian rabbis in sneakers, and just recently at B'nai Emunah. I go to watch him as I imagine he went with his father, to be with him. There are dozens of arrangements of songs and hymns from synagogue to synagogue, even between Temple Israel and B'nai Emunah, only 1.2 miles away from each other. The music can sound like it's coming from different centuries. That's part of the charm. Every year, I went to see that spark in my father. Ah, my father said at one point last week, "This one I remember. This one I recognize." I guess anything that brings you closer to your father brings you closer to God. My father has gone back to Vegas, and I am left in a new building with old questions about religion, worship, and place, where the past, present, and future never sit still. Okay, one more joke. A prospective congregant who has been visiting a particular synagogue for weeks with the intention of becoming a member announces his decision to the rabbi. "Everyone I meet," he says, "is selfish and self-centered, petty, judgmental, and attends services for all the wrong reasons. I can't possibly be a member here." "But why?" says the rabbi. "You'll fit right in."
Barry Friedman is a columnist for the Tulsa Voice, a stand-up comic, and a regular contributor to Studio Tulsa. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.